Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan, Sudan, and the region this Tuesday, December 19th, 2023. A warning about the deepening humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
All humanitarian field missions within and from Al Jazeera State have been suspended until further notice. If the fighting continues, aid distribution for some 2 million people, about a third of the population in the state, will be compromised.
And NOMA gets added to the UN's list of neglected tropical diseases, which is most prevalent in sub-Saharan Africa.
Africa is the most affected continent, but also many cases have been also, reported to Asia and the America and other regions. If, we can also find that, like, a same risk factor in other continents or other regions.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Norwegian Refugee Council reports some 300,000 civilians have been displaced in Al Jazeera State since clashes erupted between the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces and the Sudan Armed Forces in just the last few days. Wad Madani, the capital of Al Jazeera State, formerly considered a secure area for those escaping violence in Khartoum. VOA's Nabil Biagio spoke to Norwegian Refugee Council Advocacy Director for Sudan, Mathilde Vu.
Turn of events, right? Because it's not only another city that is being attacked. It's one of Sudan's remaining sanctuary that is basically becoming a war zone. Wad Madani was hosting 84,000 people who had fled the war of Khartoum. Plus, it's quite a very densely populated city. It's one of the largest cities of Sudan, and it's also one of the most important economic hub of Sudan. And, what it means right now is that this is no longer safe. My teams they basically have had to flee Wad Madani in the past few days, and they are right now in the nearby state in Sennar. And what they're telling me is that they're seeing people coming every hour, thousands of families, absolutely panicked, terrorized. Many of them so tired because it's the second time that they have to do that in the past 8 months, second time that they had to run for their life in the past 8 months. And they come into Sennar and they don't think they're safe there. So they come in with few bags, sometimes not even few bags. We have a lot of people right now crammed in schools, on the side of the road, in the open. Getting cold right now and at night, so we're also scared for them, and they actually are eager to leave even further away. So I was on the phone with my colleague just right now, and he was explaining to me the situation in Sennar. Basically men trying to jump on trucks, the first trucks that they could see in order to go further away, families running after taxis, and like cramming themselves into taxis and cars in order to leave. The panic is really there, and it's very understandable given what has happened over this past 8 months.
And this crisis has deteriorated really rapidly. Yesterday, UN OCHA was reporting 20,000 people were displaced in Al Jazeera, especially around Wad Madani. Today, we're getting reports that the RSF forces, the Rapid Support Forces, seem to have seized control of Wad Madani and the army base there, and we're seeing the numbers shooting up. Do you have the latest displacement numbers from Wad Madani and Al Jazeera at large?
Yeah, absolutely. So the situation has completely unraveled since Friday at a speed that I think nobody was ready for. Sudan was already one of the largest displacement crises in the world. There was already 6 million people displaced in Sudan and across the border. In the past 3 days, there's been 300,000 people displaced. So what it means is that we were already in one of the world's top records, and this is going to get even worse. And we don't anticipate those numbers to slow down in the coming weeks. Quite the contrary, we're seeing now that people who are fleeing, they're on a run for a long time because they don't think that that anywhere is safe at the moment. So what we're looking at is larger number of people forced to flee and who have probably nowhere to go at the moment as well.
And tell me about your response. I know all aid operations in the state have been suspended because of the fighting. What can you do and what are you doing at the moment? I know aid agencies are positioning themselves in neighboring states until the situation allows, they come back. And we're hearing desperate pleas from aid organizations like yours, like UN OCHA, got condemnations from governments, including the government of the United States. What is your response right now, and what more must be done?
Yeah, it's been heartbreaking that we have had to suspend our operation in Wad Madani. It's heartbreaking because Wad Madani was a humanitarian hub because there were so many people in need. I was there 2 months ago, and I could see how there was hundreds of families parked in a school, for example, and they had nothing. They had nothing but the assistance that they were receiving from humanitarian organizations. Now we've seen a series of statements from the international community, basically condemning and especially condemning basically the attack in Wad Madani. What we need is to go beyond the statements. We need the international community to collectively use their diplomacy to bring the parties to the conflict at the table and make sure that two things basically are safeguarded. One, civilian lives and civilian infrastructures. And that includes allowing people to flee and to flee safely, which is not the case at the moment. And second, we need to have guarantees by the parties of the conflict that international humanitarian law will be respected and that basically humanitarian assistance can reach to those in need without being attacked, without being looted. And at the moment, that sort of international pressure is missing.
That is Matilda Vu, Advocacy Director for the Norwegian Refugee Council. She was speaking to my colleague Nabil Biagio. As we just heard, UN agencies are expressing alarm at the deepening humanitarian crisis in Sudan following the seizure of Wad Madani by RSF. Most humanitarian organizations have left the area due to the ongoing fighting. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Officials at the United Nations call this latest development a devastating blow to efforts to provide life-saving assistance to millions of Sudanese whose lives have been upended by civil war. Wad Madani, Sudan's second-largest city, was a refuge for nearly 500,000 people who fled areas of intense fighting between the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces and Sudan's armed forces. The city and Al Jazeera state also operated as a key humanitarian hub. Jens Laerke, spokesman for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says all humanitarian activities there have stopped. He says organizations have been forced to temporarily suspend operations because of the fighting and relocate to neighboring states.
All humanitarian field missions within and from Al Jazeera State have been suspended until further notice. If the fighting continues, aid distribution for some 2 million people, about a third of the population in the state, will be compromised. And we need the fighting to stop so we can restart our programs for people in acute need.
The UN reports more than 12,000 people have been killed and more than 7 million have been uprooted from their homes since the war began 8 months ago. The UN Refugee Agency reports many people have moved repeatedly to find safety. Between 250,000 and 300,000 people reportedly have fled Wad Madani and surrounding areas since the clashes began. The spokesman for the UN Refugee Agency, William Spindler, says some people who had sought refuge in Wad Madani have been forced to flee to another area for safety for the second time in only a few months.
We are very worried that if the fighting further escalates and spreads to white night state, it could significantly impact the work of UNHCR and other humanitarian organizations that provide critical assistance to over 437,000 South Sudanese refugees and some 433,000 internally displaced Sudanese there.
UN agencies report nearly 25 million people in Sudan require humanitarian assistance, but it only has been possible to reach 5 million with some form of aid this year. And this, they say, is getting harder to do because of a lack of support from the international community. They warn the potential for this war to destabilize the entire region continues to grow as the scale of the crisis grows. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In an effort to address one of the world's most under-recognized health challenges, the World Health Organization recently announced the inclusion of NOMA in its official list of neglected tropical diseases. The disease is mostly found in sub-Saharan Africa. Yuka Makino, an oral health technical officer with the World Health Organization and WHO's NOMA expert, tells me that it's a disease that causes gangrene of the mouth and face that primarily affects malnourished young children in areas of extreme poverty.
Especially NOMA is, affects children between the 2 to 6 years old, and then found most commonly among the people living in poor community. And then it is reported that Africa is the most affected continent, but also many cases have been also, reported to Asia and the America and other regions. If, we can also find that like a same risk factor in other continents or other regions.
And I understand that it's mostly found in sub-Saharan Africa. Why is that?
Yeah, because as mentioned that currently, the NOMA cases more happened, mostly common in the African continent. But because this is linked with, as mentioned, that the poverty issue and also malnutrition issue. But at the same time, if this kind of risk factor also, found in other areas such as Asia or America and other regions, the NOMA case also, can be found. For example, according to the recent CISMAT review, during the last decade, 2010 to 2019, NOMA cases actually reported from 23 countries. That is not only the Africa, but also, Asia countries such as Afghanistan and also, China. And also, we also reported India and Indonesia and also, South America as well. NOMA is, prevalent in Africa region, but, beyond.
It just sounds like a horrible disease, gangrenous
exactly.
disease.
Yeah.
Like, eats part of their face or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. It just must, the manifestation must be horrible. But you point out in your press release that there are some simple things people can do to try to avoid it. What are some of those things?
Yeah, because that this one linked with, for example, nutrition issue or hygienic issue. Therefore, definitely promoting oral health and then the healthy nutrition definitely contribute to prevent the NOMA. But at the same time, because the NOMA also potentially can be linked with a curse or, witchcraft. Therefore, for example, parents found that NOMA affected children. Potentially the parents, hide the children. Therefore, we also need to educate, for example, community health worker or traditional healer, or even like a primary care worker about NOMA, because people do not know about NOMA. Raise awareness of NOMA and then avoid children go to the health clinic, late stage. Because of course NOMA is preventable, but at the same time, if the children can access the health facility early stage, they can be treated. Therefore, the raise awareness, social mobilization, and also the train the community and also the primary care worker in order to early detect and then treat and refer NOMA case really early stage.
That is Yuka Makino. She's WHO's NOMA expert, and she was speaking with me from Brazzaville in the Republic of the Congo. The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo says he is confident that tomorrow's vote will be credible, despite concerns over poor election preparations in the conflict-ridden country. Some 44 million people, or nearly half the population, are expected to vote for the next president. I take a deeper look at the top four candidates. President Felix Tshisekedi says the Democratic Republic of Congo's elections on Wednesday are crucial not only for the future of the Congo, but also for the future of Africa as a whole. He made the comments in a text to the Associated Press. Since his election in 2018, Tshisekedi has introduced free primary education and health care for pregnant mothers and babies, but he's been criticized for not doing more to help ordinary Congolese. More than 60% live on less than $2.15 a day. He's also struggled to stamp out rebel violence in the East, a cause he campaigned on. Supporters are welcoming presidential candidate Moise Katumbi in eastern DRC's capital Goma this week, one of many recent campaign stops for Katumbi, who launched his presidential bid in late November. Katumbi, a millionaire businessman, told Reuters News that he will use his network of contacts to tackle Congo's problems, including insecurity, corruption, and infrastructure obstacles.
J'ai quand même une expérience.
He says he has experience because he was governor of Katanga for over 8 years and had a positive track record. The 58-year-old made a fortune in mining, transportation, and food processing before entering politics. When he left the governorship of the copper-rich Katanga region, he made clear that he had further political ambitions. However, he fled the country after former President Joseph Kabila accused Katumbi of hiring mercenaries in a plot against the government. He vowed to return and be part of a peaceful transition.
I'm going back to Congo. I've got a peaceful fight for our country to have the first peaceful transition. I'm going back. I'm not scared about anything. I didn't do anything wrong.
Katumbi was sentenced in absentia to 3 years in prison for allegedly selling a building he did not own, and in 2018 was prevented from entering the country to run for president. He returned a year later after President Tshisekedi pardoned him. Earlier, Katumbi was allied with Tshisekedi's Sacred Union political alliance, but by the end of 2022 became a challenger to the president. He's seen as one of the opposition frontrunners, along with 67-year-old Martin Fayulu, a former oil executive and leader of the Engagement for Citizenship and Development Party. Some election observers have said that Fayulu was the real winner of the 2018 election. In an interview with VOA's French to Africa service on Monday, Fayulu says he's back to fight for a job he says is rightfully his.
Congolese, they agree with me that we have to take the power so we can build a free, strong, prosperous, and dignified Congo. I've toured the country, and the people still remember that I won the 2018 election, and they really want to do the same this time around.
But it's not clear if Fayulu wields the same support he had in 2018 when he was the umbrella opposition contender. This time, the opposition could not reach a deal over a united candidate. Another aspirant is Nobel Peace Prize winner Dr. Denis Mukwege, who won the prize for his work on sexual violence in warfare. In an exclusive interview in October with VOA's French to Africa, Mukwege said he is running although he thinks the election process is flawed. He said he went ahead with his campaign because laws and human rights are not respected and because the country's vast mineral resources are not used to benefit the population. Some doubt remains about the ability of the Congolese Electoral Commission to organize the ballot on time. The DRC is roughly the size of continental Western Europe and has very few roads. Last week, the government asked the United Nations peacekeeping mission in the country to help transport voting materials after having long publicly criticized the force. The UN agreed on Friday to do so. The Washington Post says U.S. President Joe Biden has started pushing Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to accept a day-after plan that would put the Palestinian territories on a path to eventual statehood. The editorial says the U.S. and Arab nations should prepare now for the day after the shooting stops, laying the groundwork to restart the process of creating two states, Israel and Palestine, that are not locked in perpetual conflict. Ayman Zine Eldin, former director of media at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry and former Egyptian ambassador to Spain, discussed this with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
I think everybody now agrees that a lot of work needs to be done, and the conflict has to be brought to a settlement as soon as this is possible. The point is that after what happened over the last two or so months and what we have all witnessed and recognized as the positions by the Israeli government that expressly said that it is not interested in the peace process that was conceived in Oslo some 30 years ago. So we are faced with the reality that there is a lot of work that needs to be done as a peace process. I think the underlying factors for a settlement are not there yet. We have a problem with Israeli political positions, and that represents so far at least the majority of the Israeli population that is not interested in a settlement, but more interested in annexing the territories of the West Bank and possibly the Gaza Strip. And we have also a situation in the Palestinian territories with the destruction that has been taking place in Gaza and a similar destruction that was taking place in the West Bank. And that has to be revisited and a better environment created for a settlement. Otherwise, we'll be engaging in an exercise of self-deception, maybe a lip service. I think the United States on its part needs to work on Israel to make sure that Israel is brought back to the mentality of a settlement, but also all of us, Egypt included, but also the Arab nations, need to work with the Palestinian side to rebuild the Palestinian community, society, polity, economy, so that it's in a better position to engage in a final settlement. So yes, final settlement work has to start at the earliest possible time, but for it to happen, a lot of groundwork needs to be done.
The United States will need Arab nations' help, both in rebuilding Gaza and in giving legitimacy to a refreshed Palestinian Authority. What role do you envision for Egypt on that?
Of course, Egypt has always been engaged actively in support for Gaza particularly, but Palestine in general, Gaza because of proximity and the historical connection between Egypt and Gaza. And I think that that is taking place now with the help that is being provided to Gaza, where Egypt is among the most prominent providers of relief to Gaza now. And I think that will continue to be the case after the war ends. But I think now, with the rebuilding of Gaza, I think the West and Israel should bear the main responsibility. The destruction that is happening now in Gaza is undertaken by Israel with the full support of many Western countries, particularly the United States, but others as well, that gave Israel clear cover that it has the free hand to undertake whatever military action it deems necessary with all the civilian damage. So I think the Western countries should bear the main responsibility. I think also Israel should be held responsible. There has to be some discussion of reparations so that the rebuilding of Gaza is essentially carried out at the expense of those who bear the main responsibility. But of course, the Arab countries will have to chip in, and I'm sure they will be chipping in. But I say Israel in particular needs to learn that its actions, its choices come with a cost. Otherwise, we will be rebuilding Gaza for it only to be destroyed again and again, like it has been being destroyed again and again in the past. As to the legitimacy of the refreshed Palestinian Authority, I think that is an important quest. I think this legitimacy has to be based on two pillars. The first pillar would be the space that would be given to the Palestinian Authority to act on behalf of the Palestinian people. Because one of the reasons why the Palestinian Authority currently is facing so much trouble with the Palestinian population, with its ability to lead, is because this space has been restricted and its role has been defined by carrying out the tasks Israel wants. That's what Israel has been asking of the Palestinian Authority. That's what the United States has been asking the Palestinian Authority, to ensure the security of Israel and to restrain those elements that are in opposition to Israel, to work on the education system and so on and so forth. This is why the Palestinian Authority has been lacking in legitimacy. The other pillar is to what extent it represents the aspirations of the Palestinian people, to what extent it emerged from as a legitimate Palestinian process. And I think elections that are open, free and fair to elect the representatives of the Palestinian people should be critical in ensuring the legitimacy of the Palestinian entity that will be taking care of the Palestinian people. Otherwise, we will be repeating the same mistakes.
That is Ayman Zine Eldin, former director of media at the Egyptian Foreign Ministry and former Egyptian ambassador to Spain. He was speaking with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawi. Conservationists in Kenya warn that nearly all the country's 103 species of raptors have declined. These wildlife advocates are now proposing the construction of bird-friendly infrastructure to avert possible extinction. Francis Ontemowa has this report from Nakuru, Kenya.
Doug the tawny eagle has learned to stand on an artificial leg. Sometimes finding his balance is tough. 2 years ago, Doug received an electric shock while perching on a power line, injuring not only his leg, but also his left wing. The Soysambu Raptor Center, situated in Kenya's Rift Valley, helps injured birds like Doug. Dr. Juliet Wayaki, a resident veterinarian here, says harm to birds is usually caused by one of three things.
Persecution, electrocution, and poisoning. Those are mostly the cases we get to experience here.
This crown eagle's encounter with power lines left her with damage to her eyes, wing, and brain. The species is listed as near threatened by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, a global authority in the field. Kenya is home to 103 species of birds of prey, or raptors. In recent years, the country's human population has grown, encroaching on the birds' habitat and installing miles of deadly electric lines. Simon Thomset is the manager of the Soysambu Raptor Center.
The 10 to 32 kV poles being put up nationally, the rate that they're putting up is incredibly impressive. But that also means that the rate of deaths would be proportional to the amount of lethal poles that are being put in.
A 2022 study published in the journal Biological Conservation found that raptors are on a catastrophic decline. In Kenya, sightings of the once common raptors, such as the ogre buzzards, hooded vultures, and the long-crested eagles, are down by more than 80% in 40 years. Thomset says he has dedicated his entire life to protecting raptors.
I think what people seem to think is that you're a professional conservationist, you're getting paid to do this job. We're not. We do everything pro bono.
Researchers say raptors can help reduce farmers' losses by feeding on the rodents that eat their crops. They also help eliminate disease-carrying carcasses from the environment. But researchers say the birds' feeding habits can also put them at risk of injury or death if they ingest prey species such as mice or rats that have been poisoned. Peter Njoroge heads the ornithology department at the National Museums of Kenya. He says there are ways to build infrastructure like power lines while also protecting birds.
There is bird-friendly infrastructure for transmission that will protect the birds, that will help conserve birds of prey. And to go further on that, it's better when they are planning these things that they use bird-friendly infrastructure than to retrofit later on.
But the authors of the 2022 study also say further raptor declines could be prevented if the government put species recovery plans in place. Francis Ontomoa, VOA News, Nakuru, Kenya.
And that wraps it up for us this Tuesday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you miss this broadcast somehow, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Salam Ya Sudan by Victoria Ole and Kassan Dedi. We've been listening to Salam Ya Sudan by Victoria Ole and Kassan Dedi. I am your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, and producer, Gwen Newton, thanks for tuning in. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Salam.